Welcome to the dialogue series Dancing in the Liminal, a global border-crossing inquiry into art, activism, spirituality, and leadership for the 21st century. I'm your dialogue hostess, Vanessa Fisher, and I'm here with my guest, Gilles Harada. Gilles is a life coach, research scientist, and an internationally published writer who has worked at the universities of Nice, Paris, Columbia, and Harvard. Gilles has also attended and facilitated programs in personal development, giving him the rare opportunity to be a gay man in conversation with homophobic men in an open and intimate setup. This offered him a unique chance to inquire into the mechanisms of homophobia, which has come to inform his book. Gilles has also been a friend of mine for the last 5 years or so, and his work will be featured in an upcoming anthology on sex and gender issues that I co-edited and will be published this year with an academic press. So I've been following Gilles's work for some time now, and I find him to be a really fascinating, unique, and complex thinker. I'm really looking forward to discussing his recently published book, The Missing Myth, A New Vision of Same-Sex Love, and diving into what I know will be a really unique conversation on homosexuality. So it's a real pleasure to have you here, Gilles, and welcome.
Hello, Vanessa. Great to be with you.
So there's a lot about your book that I'd like to discuss. There's a lot of really complex ideas. And so what I'd like to do is just sort of dance around some of the core topics and ideas in your book and work at painting sort of a broader picture for our audience about the kinds of original ideas and research you're doing into the topic of homosexuality and same-sex love. So one of the core premises of your book, it's called The Missing Myth. And you argue in your book that the reason homosexuality finds itself in the fragmented state that it is in today is because it's lacking a proper mythos. So I was wondering if maybe we could just start by having you explain a little bit about what you mean by this missing mythos, how that informs the central thesis of your book.
That was really an interesting thing to discover for me. And, I'm a research scientist by training in neuroscience, but I'm really trained as a researcher, right? I can't help but try to connect the dots. Mm-hmm. And there was something about homosexuality that was interesting. In many ways, we could not understand why it has the history that it has. Why was it accepted in some cultures? Why is it rejected in some cultures? All the explanations that had been offered actually do not withstand a deeper analysis. Typically, if you accuse the Bible, then you need to understand why communist China sent homosexuals to re-education camps. You see, the whole thing just doesn't make sense. And what happened is that I suddenly noticed that the only thing that actually correlates whether and how homosexuality and homosexual relationships are accepted in a culture is the way homosexual desire and homosexual love is represented in the myth of that particular culture. Mm-hmm. And that was rather simple, because if you actually look, pretty much every culture on human culture on planet Earth had some version of some representation of homosexual desire in their mythology. And interestingly, Christianity didn't have any. There was love between men, love between women, but that love was carefully presented in a way that sexual desire and the body were not involved in that relationship. And then I started to kind of like really look at what is the importance of mythology in human culture. And then I started to read and discover that really mythologies are really space of knowledge, the collection of archetypes that basically help us understand who we are as human beings. So part of the work I had to do, you see, the problem with mythologies, right, is that we can recognize them in cultures that are, within quotes, less developed than we are, right? So we can distinguish very clearly Greek mythology. You know, most of us will be able to distinguish a Christian mythology. However, when we move, then we enter modernity and eventually the postmodern era and our times, then what in the culture can be called mythology or myth becomes really difficult to catch. And the reason for that is that mythology, when it's alive in a culture, is never seen as a mythology. It's seen as the truth.
Right.
So basically, the mythology of our time is what we call our truth. That, you know, in a few generations later, they will probably see that as a particular vision or worldview of the world that, you know, eventually will be obsolete too.
Right. And there's been a backlash to myth within some of the scientific paradigm, obviously, which has contributed to some of that.
Yeah, so it's really interesting because when modernity started to distinguish myth, it's sort of like denied its own dependence on myth, on its own mythology, right? Because again, we always see our own symbolic framework as the truth.
Right, yeah. And so you look at myths throughout history, the myths that have led up to, myths that have included same-sex love, and then where we are today. And what would you say is, what's the missing piece right now? So if we're in modern, postmodern times now, what's that missing piece that we're in right now that is this critical juncture point?
Well, it's interesting because the missing myth right now has been the missing myth for over 2 millennia now. So something really interesting happens with the rise of Christianity and the rise of the Christian mythos, is that suddenly you have, you know, and to make a very long story short, you have a vision of the divine that is overall totally disconnected from sexuality, right? Prior Christianity, sexuality was part of the divine. It was one of the energies that moved the universe. The God of Judaism and eventually Christianity is a God that has no sexuality and is a God that is creating through his world, right? So first you have the emergence of a mythology where sex is no longer part of the divine. It's actually worse because that's really strong, very strong in Christianity. Sex is actually what takes you away from the divine, right? Because basically, sex grounds you in your material, physical reality. That is a big problem for Christianity. Even for Augustine, for instance, sex is the original sin. So you have an entire mythology that regards sex as a source of evil, that takes you away from God. And then, of course, homosexuality is viewed as exactly the same thing, as sex for pleasure. So it is basically deleted out, which is basically sex in general and homosexual sex in particular is totally absent from the Christian mythos. However, when it comes to homosexuality, the fathers of the church were particularly creative, and they didn't just delete out homosexual desire from their mythos. They actually reinvented an old Jewish legend, the legend of Sodom and Gomorrah, that was totally reinterpreted in such a way that the lust of men for other men became the very sin for which God destroyed those cities, right? So not only it is deleted from the mythos as like there's no positive vision of same-sex desire in the Christian mythos, but there is actually a really strong legend, a myth that is appended to the Christian mythos that associates homosexual desire with sin and divine punishment.
And one of the things I love about your book is that you really contextualize like all of this in a really big historical narrative of what's happening in the larger culture at the time. And I wondered if you want to talk a little bit, I mean, there's a lot we could go into, but so this shift that happened with Christianity and the mythos was happening within a much larger context. So why this particular shift happened at this time and why it was seen as important to, you know, the founders of the church at that time. and the shift from pre-Christian cultures. Do you want to just share a little bit about what was that shift like? Why was homosexuality part of the mythos before the era? Why was that accepted? And what was the shift that was happening in this time?
Yeah. Part of what was important for me was to not make history wrong and really understand why people shifted, why people embraced a different worldview, even though from my personal perspective now, centuries later, it feels kind of like, you know, jumping from the cliff. Christianity is really best understood that about what's called the Axial Age. If anything, that's a really, really, I find it a really, really important historical distinction. So it's basically that major civilization breakthrough that occurred from Greece to China, more or less, and that's epitomized by Greek philosophers of classical Greece, by some Jewish prophets like Ezekiel, Zoroaster in Persia. In India, it's the shift from early Hinduism to classical Hinduism, the emergence of Buddhism. In China, the philosophy of Lao Tzu and Confucius. The big name for that is the Axial Age. And what they have in common is that Axial Age thinkers had suddenly a totally different vision of the divine and a totally different vision of human nature. Before that, gods were very much in the world. They were very present. They were all pretty much in the same plan as human beings, even though they had superpowers. The vision of what the divine represents for Axial thinkers was what's called the transcendental breakthrough, that suddenly there was a realm that was outside of the material universe. So then you have this like God, right, in Judaism and eventually in Christianity, that is distinct from its creation. You have consciousness in Buddhism. You have Brahma in Hinduism. You have the Tao in China. And those are really a vision of the divine that's unified, first, and that is transcendent to the universe. Their vision of human nature was parallel to that. Human beings had a consciousness, a mind or a soul, depending really on the perspective that you take. And that mind, consciousness, soul was distinct from the energies coming from the body. They were distinct from the desires that you have, the emotions that you have, the impulses that you have.
Right. And for a lot of, you know, modern and postmodern people, if we look back, I mean, we can have a lot of reactions about the repression and things that were happening, but it's something you bring out in the book, which, you know, in the historical context, this was actually, you know, a pretty big move, an important move in a certain way, because before this time, you know, people were kind of overtaken by their emotions,
completely,
their passions, in a way completely that they could, you know, and they assumed it was the gods, like, controlling them.
Exactly.
You know, they didn't have any differentiation.
Exactly. So, you know, it's, for instance, like, that's really typical. You will, when you read the Odyssey, right, by Homer, this is what you see, right? You see those, like, Greek warriors that are basically overtaken by their emotions, and their emotions are the whims of the gods that are basically acting through them.
Yeah.
So Axial thinkers really had to deal with that. Yeah. And they find ways and teachings and practices so that people could differentiate and control all those energies, right? You see that in Buddhism, you see that in Judaism, there is in Christianity. And in the West, there was this commitment to protect the mind or the soul from the impulses of the body. And you see really all Axial thinkers urging their contemporaries to differentiate themselves from all those impulses. And suddenly a wise man was suddenly someone that was a man who had an independent mind, mm-hmm. who could think, whose mind was no longer the slave of all those urges coming from the body. So it's such an important insight, and we could not function without having that insight in the background. But yes, the mode at that time was basically to either repress the body or deny the body.
Yeah. And was there was also a shift, I mean, so homosexuality was obviously a threat, particularly because it was sexuality without any purpose, you could say, in the worldview of that time. You know, sex between heterosexuals was problematic enough, but you know, between homosexuals, it would have been even more a potential place for unbridled passion, I would imagine.
Well, it was sex for pleasure,
right?
And any sex for pleasure was deemed sinful. You know, heterosexual sex wasn't so valued. Remember that Christianity values mm-hmm. chastity more than heterosexual sex.
Yeah.
And basically Christianity and the fathers of the church had to solve a terrible equation, which was basically that if they were denying sex completely, they were basically ensuring the death of their own church.
Little
right?
Problem.
which has actually which was the case in some Gnostic sects in the Middle East. And that didn't, they were not particularly successful, as you can imagine. So Christianity basically eventually came to a consensus, which was sex was okay as long as it was with the goal of reproduction.
Yeah. And so, well, let's go backwards a little bit. So what I loved about your book is just how much history and, you know, just the amount of research you've done and condensed in a really, I think, comprehensive and fascinating way. And I learned a lot that, I mean, I thought I knew quite a bit, but I definitely learned more reading your book. And I thought, you know, for our listeners, it would just be fascinating to look a little bit at the history of homosexuality. You start looking at, you know, in animals, in chimpanzees and bonobos, and then start looking at some of the pre-Christian cultures. I'd love to talk a little bit about that with you, and then can dive into a bit more of, you know, what you see as kind of the emerging mythos, or what could be the mythos for homosexuality today. Would that work for you? Yeah?
Sure.
Okay.
Let's do that.
So why don't you just share a little bit about, I mean, one of the big arguments that you still hear in evolutionary biology, evolutionary sciences, is that homosexuality doesn't really have any reproductive purpose. It doesn't have an evolutionary purpose. So it's been hard to explain why, you know, why it's existed and has existed in animal species. So do you want to just share a little bit of your ideas around that and kind of the conclusions you came to? And maybe a little bit about, for people who don't know, what is the homosexual activity for animals and chimpanzees, bonobos?
Yeah. So we have these like two close cousins, right? Chimpanzees and bonobos. And I think we are slightly closer mm-hmm. from chimpanzees.
Weren't chimpanzees also more aggressive too?
Yes, they are. And so are human beings.
Yeah.
We are very aggressive species. But yeah, we do practice war, and we raid our neighbors, rape. Often we practice cannibalism. There are many things that we do, and we discovered in recent decades, really, that chimpanzees also do it, which is really interesting. And bonobos are very different. Bonobos are vegetarian, and they are smaller also. They are much less aggressive. However, when it comes to homosexuality, human beings are different from both, because when you check display of homosexual behavior in primates in general and apes in particular, homosexual behavior is displayed by pretty much every member in the group. It's part of the sexual repertoire. Its frequency can vary depending on the species, usually, but there's no specialized individual when it comes to sexual orientation. That is really something that appears among primates to be unique to the human species. In the human species, there is that spectrum of sexuality where there is a great majority of the group that is essentially interested in heterosexual pairing. There is a tiny minority, maybe 2 to 3%, that appears to be exclusively interested in homosexual pairings. And then in between, there is, it's difficult to say. My estimate would be between 15, maybe 30% of human beings that seem to be potentially interested in both. And then you would see that fuzzy in-between category shrink or expand depending on historical cultural circumstances, right? So in cultures where you see homosexual behavior is rewarding, for instance, classical Greece, those people do engage in homosexual behavior. In cultures that are highly repressive when it comes to homosexual behavior, then those people definitely just forget about. They don't engage in homosexual behavior. Apparently, right? This is what we see. And that homosexual sexual orientation seems to be a unique trait in the human species.
So how did it exist? Like, what was its purpose for bonobos and chimpanzees? Was there an evolutionary purpose for the existence of homosexuality?
Yeah. What happens in several species in what you can call higher mammals, but that would be true in apes, many species of monkeys, in dolphin, rams, you see that sex for pleasure, becomes much more developed to a point where it is a very important social activity in the group. And what you see is that sex is really important to create bonding. It basically organizes the network of relationships within the group. And it has actually a slightly different nature among males and among females. Among females, at least, and I'm talking now essentially about bonobos and probably human beings, and I'm talking also about homosexual interactions now. Homosexual interactions among females create bonding. Basically, females that are usually physically much smaller and weaker than males and vulnerable to males' aggressivity can form friendships and create strong relationship with other females. And in bonobos, for instance, you see that if a male attacks or try to rape, have its way with a female, other female that have a relationship with that female would intervene. And basically, the male will run away very quickly, totally overpowered by the females. In males, it also creates bonding and relationships and friendship. However, there is something specific to males, is that males are very sensitive to ranking. They're actually obsessed with rankings. This is really true in chimpanzees. This is less true, yet not absent, among bonobos, and this is definitely true among humans, right? Males are obsessed with the ranking order that organize the male members within the group. And you see that homosexual interactions are very much structured according to ranking, where basically the penetration acts will reflect the ranking order.
Yeah, social ranking.
Social ranking.
So the insertive partner is always a higher level male in the group than the person who's going to be receiving.
Like, needless to say, yeah, the one that penetrates is the one on top.
Right. So this is important for social cohesion. It's not just about the arguments that it doesn't have reproductive value, but it does have evolutionary value in the sense of cohesing groups and social groups.
What is really important to understand is that in social animals, and look, we see that in insects as much as we see that among primates and apes and human beings. The cohesion of the group is actually a very important factor for the protection, for the safety of the offspring. The more you have a group that is socially coherent and strong, the more that group can compete efficiently with other groups to access food, to expand its territory, which also implies more food, to often be able to steal the females from other neighboring groups that have been defeated. So you actually really improve reproduction by reinforcing social cohesion. So one of the things that I'm really defending is that homosexuality is not an anomaly in the reproductive strategy of the human species. It is actually part, it is at the heart of it. It is actually at the heart of it, because basically we are a species that has favored social bonding and strong social organization, right, so as to increase the survival of the offspring. And look, we've been amazingly efficient.
Right.
We've been amazingly successful at it.
As this transfers over into human cultures, would you say the same mechanism was in play in pre-Christian era as well?
Yeah, so basically when you see how homosexual behaviors and homosexual relationships were organized in traditional societies, mm-hmm, it is always carefully crafted. The traditions, right, the customs around homosexuality are carefully crafted so that the reproductive relationships or interactions are absolutely protected and enhanced, actually, regardless of the number of homosexual interactions that can occur, mm-hmm, within that group. The duty of reproduction was always paramount. Always. And anybody who would engage in homosexual behavior, as soon as they were sexually mature, they had to, mm-hmm, start their own family and basically reproduce. That is true in ancient Greece. That is true in throughout Asia. That is true in Africa. That is true really across the board. There is only one category, which is rather small, of males, and occasionally there are also cases of females that were allowed not to reproduce, and those were feminized males or masculinized females. In native Indian culture, it's called the Berdash, or two spirits, that maybe some people listening to us now might know about. In India, they are called the Ijwas, the Fahafafin in Pacific cultures, or the Mahu, different names. Those were males that were considered as having, either considered as being females or having a third gender. There was no pressure on those gender-transformed males to reproduce. However, mm-hmm, it was mandatory for the males, the stud males, that had sex with those feminized males, that those males would have a progeny. Mm-hmm. So it was managed very, very precisely.
Well, that's what I liked about, one of the many things I like about your book, and I want to come back to it again when we talk more about myths, but it was around this piece too, was you don't romanticize the past. Like, your account of the past is, you know, like, you do the hard research and you're sharing, but you're not making the implication that we should go backwards or that this was better than what we have now or any of that particular, you know, discourse which is out there. You know, I mean, I don't know if you want to share, but like some of the, you know, highly ritualized behaviors of homosexuality, you know, in pre-Christian culture, some of them were quite, I mean, we consider by today's standards to be quite violent.
Totally.
So do you want to share just a little bit of that, or just your thoughts?
Sure. Well, then first, I think the first statement that we would make is that male homosexuality in traditional society is a male privilege.
Right.
It comes from cultures where the unquestioned belief is that males are entitled to basically sexually penetrate whoever they want, as long as their status as males was not in jeopardy. We haven't talked so much about female homosexuality. There is a very different perspective and a different set of data that needs to be unearthed for that.
Yeah.
But also, traditional homosexualities were structured systematically in such a way that the dominant male was always the one, the top, you would say today, right? The one who was basically penetrating the other one. it was not, you know, there was no question. Like if you were like a boy, a young man, and you had sex with an older male, you were not given the choice. You were the one who was being penetrated. And that was it. That was it. If you were a feminized male, same thing. Sexual diversity and sexuality as an expression of the self, that is a totally foreign concept in traditional culture. It is very foreign in traditional Christianity too. It is a very important thing for us now, but it's something that really emerged in the last 2 centuries, maybe even less than that. You know, it's really interesting because gay intellectuals, gay scholars, I understand, we all had kind of like a commitment, and it was very tempting to oppose a very repressive Christian culture to those, you know, liberal, permissive, traditional cultures when it comes to homosexual behavior and homosexual desire. But when you actually look at how homosexual behavior was structured morally and practically in those cultures, there was very little room for self-expression, for personal choice, for personal preferences. Not to mention that in most cases, those sexualities would qualify as sexual abuse. Not systematically, but often.
Right, right. Well, you mentioned, we can talk a little bit about, you mentioned, you know, in the book you say that the history of homosexuality really is of male homosexuality. At least the documented history is mainly male homosexuality. So do you want to just say a little bit about why women's, you know, same-sex love was not documented as much historically and what you might think are some of the differences?
Yeah. But there are probably many, many reasons. The 2 major reasons, I think, are this. First, men have dominated the social spheres for a very, very long time. There are those who have left the most written traces about everything, right? So when we read history, it's the history that has been, by and large, written by men, and about men, often. The other thing of this issue is that traditional cultures have been far less preoccupied with female homosexuality than they were with male homosexuality. And the reason is this difference, that females are not preoccupied with ranking. Males are. So male homosexuality had to be really carefully structured, carefully ritualized. There were customs, there were sets of morals, aesthetic rules that were followed, I mean, depending on the culture, where basically homosexual interactions among males were codified. It was specified very carefully in the habits of that culture. When it comes to female sexuality, the main obsession has, for males, I think, has been to make sure that females were not chilling with other men and basically would have get pregnant with men, other men than their husbands, right? That has been really the main concern. Mm-hmm. In many ways, the fact that they would actually play with other females has been much less threatening, as long as nobody knew about it, right, because that would basically not affect their social rank and their reputation. I think in many ways, probably, as long as females were willing to be discreet, right, not being too outspoken about their sexuality, there probably a lot of lesbian sex happened in harems, right, you know, in this like all-female environments. We just, nobody is there to tell us the stories, right, unfortunately.
I mean, you're very upfront in your book that, you know, that's a whole history that you don't have as much information on. So the book tends to focus more on male homosexuality. But I think you do a really good job of, you know, speaking to those points when you can. So when you look at, you know, you take sort of the pre-Christian cultures and then Christianity and the huge legacy that is left on the mythos and, you know, homosexuality identity. And then, yeah, like you've said in the talk, that this emergence of modern homosexuality really is a unique thing. It's not the same as what we had in traditional cultures. It's a very unique manifestation of a homosexual identity for men and women. So did you want to talk a little bit about that, and then we can maybe go into to talk more about the myth, you know, that you think is emerging today. But what do you think is the biggest difference in what we're seeing happening today than what was around in traditional cultures?
Yeah. So the situation, right, in traditional cultures is that you have quasi-omnipresent male homosexuality, male homosexual relationships that are structured according to ranking. And then you have probably female homosexuality that is hidden in the background. Modern homosexuality, we see the premises of that in the literature in the 19th century. I kind of trace... Right. Yes. The first emergence of it in the love of mm-hmm. comrades in Walt Whitman poet. It really only emerges socially as a real social reality, primarily in America, right during and after World War II. And that, the kind of relationship, the homosexual culture that emerged at that time and very quickly would spread to North America and Europe, is totally different. Suddenly, the standard, the moral standard, is a relationship between two men or two women that are equal in status. They are about the same age. They are coming from similar social backgrounds with similar educations. And that, from an evolutionary standpoint, it's a revolution. It's a revolution. Never ever was it allowed in traditional cultures that two adult males would actually have sex together, because that would mean that at least one of them would endorse the passive role, and that was a source of social discredit, humiliation. That male would basically lose its status as a male. Not only that, but modern homosexuality value a lot versatility, which is that it's not imposed, but it is valued that you actually embrace both the passive and the active role, sexually speaking. That is also totally foreign in previous homosexual cultures. And the same applies to women. Suddenly, women are viewed as... lesbians are the counterpart of the male homosexuals, which is also not the case in traditional cultures, where female homosexuality was one thing and male homosexuality was another thing. They were really not particularly viewed as related. So that's very important. So we tend to think that modern homosexuality or homosexuality today is a reemergence of homosexuality that existed before the time it was repressed. But when you actually look at it from as a relational form, it's a creation. It's basically it's a creation. It's something that never existed before, and it's pretty amazing actually to see that emerge. I mean, I find it actually quite moving.
Yeah, and I it's an important point. I think, like, I'd like to kind of inquire with you on that a bit, because I think, I mean, this is a similar. It's a similar kind of discourse that happens in, you know, in women's circles and the feminist movement too, around, you know, and we can tie this into your sense of what is this mythos that you think is emerging now that really is not what we had in the past. It's not, it's definitely got to move beyond this Christian, you know, repression, but it can't be just in reaction to that, trying to go back to the past to emancipate something that perhaps we think is there that may not be there. You do mention in the book, I mean, because this is something feminist scholars are constantly looking at also. So I think you said there's two pitfalls to watch for. One is like kind of romanticizing the past or going back to the past to try to take myths from the past and put them into a postmodern context. Is that accurate to what you said? Or yeah. Do you want to explain a little bit about that? And then you can tie that into, you know, what do you see as the pitfalls? And then what do you see do we need to do to really create this new mythos that would kind of embrace the new kind of emergence homosexuality that we're really seeing?
Yeah. So I describe two pitfalls, in my opinion. So the first one that you didn't mention is basically those people that, and often they are really brilliant scholars, so, you know, I need to be really respectful of their work, and I want to, but they kind of like force reinterpret the sacred text, in particular
right.
the Bible.
They want to find like a pro-homosexual message kind of in the Bible. Right.
Exactly, in a way that is more favorable to homosexuals. And we've seen everything, right? We've seen Jesus having a relationship with John, having a relationship with Lazarus. Of course, the friendship of David and Jonathan, that's a classic in that kind of literature. And just assuming, kind of like trying to detect through the loving bond between those men that that must have been sexual. And the truth is that we don't care. we actually don't care. We don't care because first, we don't even know if those
right.
people existed, right? That's the first thing. Second, we will never find out if they were having sex or not. And the reality is actually remotely interesting because the only thing that is actually active in the culture is not the reality,
right.
it's the myth.
Exactly.
And the myth exists on its own. And you can pretend that the myth is something else, but the myth will still be the myth, right? So you don't attack a myth by pretending that something different really happened. It's not how it works. And I think it's, you know, from a scholarly standpoint, those are really pretty shaky work. I don't think there is anything really convincing in this. Anyway, however, the other pitfall. I'm certainly not the first homosexual on this planet that realized that homosexuality, as we know it today, was disconnected from the sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And there is actually a main figure, and his name is Harry Hay, that started the whole Mattachine Society and eventually the whole Radical Fairy movement. And around it, there is what's called the Gay Spirituality Movement. There were many people that tried to reconnect homosexual desire and homosexual love and physical interaction between men and between women to a sense of sacred. And the intention was an amazing breakthrough, of course, right? Essential. However, as far as I can tell, in their great majority, and I actually know only one exception, who is Toby Johnson, those thinkers and activists basically went backward in a way that they thought that ancient mythologies that talk about gender fluidity, that talk about sex between men, that talked about desire between women, could actually be recycled. We become alive again in our culture. And the reality is that, first, that their audience has remained really limited. So in a way, their message didn't take off. And my explanation of it is that basically old myths were appropriate for old cultures. They were consistent. So those myths were consistent with the type of consciousness that was present in the culture that held those myths as true. This is no longer applicable to us because we've been through 2 millennia of monotheism, and there was, like, you know, a good reason for that. We went through three centuries of modernity and perhaps like a good century of postmodernity, and we are certainly moving beyond that now. Our consciousness, our understanding of the universe is way, way, way more complex. That doesn't mean we are more intelligent. We just have a more complex vision of the universe. Those myths are no longer a match for the type of consciousness that we embody. And the other thing is that they tend to forget also that those myths, you know, Isis or, you know, the goddess or whatever, they were often really, really violent myths. When you read those, like, old stories, when you actually read those old stories, just not, you know, some the excerpt that you're interested in. They are definitely not a moral compass for us. Not at all. They might be interesting. I'm not saying that there isn't like a wisdom. I'm not saying that there isn't something that that cannot inspire us in some ways. It's just we just haven't done the work. We just haven't done the work, which is to recognize a mythic reality that is a match for the type of consciousness that we are today.
Right. And now that we've spoken about that, what, you know, this is kind of central to your book is, you know, what do you see as this potential emerging mythos? I imagine it both includes everything that's come before and yet also takes it, you know, into a new context. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? I know you talk a lot about the role of science, which I found really interesting because, you know, science has kind of been, you know, for the homosexuality community, it's been a very contentious relationship. So do you want to talk a little bit about that? And
So a mythology or a mythos, I prefer the term mythos because we tend to identify myth and or mythologies to a set of stories that are clearly recognizable as a mythology, right? I like to use the term mythos as what fulfills the role of myth and mythologies, and yet we don't have to recognize or know it as a mythology, right? So that's I use the term mythos to open the mind to something that is a little less recognizable than we think, actually, much less recognizable. So the mythos has different functions, right? One of the functions that it has, it's basically like an ontological repertoire. The mythos gives life to all the major archetypes. So when you see the Greek mythology, for instance, the gods were basically describing everything a human being could be. They were like a mirror. The mythos is an ontological mirror of the human psychological reality. So that's one aspect. And you see that regarding homosexuality specifically, you see that emerge in literature first, at the beginning of the 20th century. You start to see novels that describe homosexual love. Homosexual sex is described in European literature. You see that now in movies, in paintings. So that representation, right? However, myth have a particular, or the mythos, it's not whatever representation. It's a representation that connects you to a sense of the sacred. And the sacred is basically what is fundamentally human. The mythos tells you also something important in that connection to the sacred, which is that it tells you where we are coming from, why it is that we are on this planet, and where we are going. It basically gives meaning to human life. Because science is really the big storyteller today. Science is really the what I call the myth creator. Science is the one that is starting to tell us where we are coming from, how it is that we emerge from nothing, how it is that we actually emerge within evolution. So the Big Bang story, the evolution of the species, the creation of Earth, the new cosmology, right, and natural history that the scientific narrative provides to us has, in my opinion, a mythic nature, its essence, right? And science is starting to talk about homosexuality, but the stories that it has are way too patchy. Like, they are so fragmented. So, science is still so trying to wrap its mind up around it. So we don't have like a clear, beautiful narrative. I try in the book to reconstitute a patchwork for what it is, right? For what it is, given the data that we have today, so that people can start to have a sense of the kind of narrative that will emerge. And I think really what's happening with science, that you like it or not, but science is making sense of homosexuality, is actually starting to understand why homosexual behavior appears in evolution, why it's been selected, why it is it is an advantage for the human species and human groups. It is by no means yet something that I would call a myth, but I think that there is a potential for a narrative that would basically reconnect homosexual behavior to the very evolutionary journey of human beings on this planet.
You do such a lot in the book that we can't cover in the whole interview, but I do like the way you look at, you know, you totally validate the importance of science, but you also don't limit it to science. You really look at, like, the interior of the individual. You look at the culture, the morals, mm-hmm. you know, picture for homosexuality. You look at the scientific. So to me, it's just a very comprehensive, you know, the aesthetic, you know, you really take a very comprehensive look and don't limit it to any one, you know, strain of, you know, domain of knowledge or perspective. So that's what I think is great about the book, too. You leave it quite open. Maybe because we're running short on time, but I did want to just hear a little bit about what you think are some of the biggest, you know, I mean, obviously there's lots you could say, but some of the biggest stumbling blocks that the homosexual community now is facing, the queer, transgender community in general. Just what do you think in the postmodern context is going to be the biggest, you know, struggles to kind of move forward in the next, you know, next while and really, take in this larger picture that you're aiming to construct?
Yeah. Well, I think what we can say is that the gay community is slowly winning the political fight for its acceptance, right? It's not equal everywhere. But if we kind of look at what the trend has been, it's been remarkably successful at a historical scale to see really a group of people that were so marginalized 50 years ago be now integrated the way we see that. So on the political front, I think it's been pretty amazing. What we need to, what I urge the gay community to realize is that there is another front that we have basically left completely open and unexplored, and where we remain defeated, which is basically our symbolic reality in human culture, what it is that we want to represent. And that will be very important, because this is where symbolic / social reality, our representation in the mythos, would anchor. And I understand that in a very fluid way, right? I'm someone that has an evolutionary developmental vision of everything. So I'm not preaching for a fixed mythos about homosexuality. That whatever symbolic, mythic reality that we need to invent, we need to invent it again and again and again, as we will discover more about ourselves and what it is that we want to embody in our cultures and in the universe, really. The vast territory where symbols and myth can actually emerge, science being one of them, art and literature being another part of that, the media, and use everything, use all the tools. And I think only then would our fight and struggle for integration be much easier. That's my prediction. Mm-hmm. When we would know symbolically who we are, and when who we are is connected to the sacred, that it is deeply something part of human nature, that we are not no longer an anomaly in this world, but we are part of what it is to be a human being.
Well, and I would just encourage people, there's a lot of stuff you go into in the book we won't have time to cover in the dialogue, but you really, you know, look at this applied to issues like same-sex marriage and different issues, mm-hmm. and I just think it's a great read if people are interested in the topics. We didn't get to talk about it a lot today, but you know, the history of homophobia and how that has informed the homosexual discourse. And I think there's a lot of very fascinating mm-hmm. insights there too. So I just want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me. And
my pleasure.
It's a real fascinating read for me. So I appreciate you're out there doing the work you're doing.
Okay, I hope my French accent wouldn't be too difficult for
them. No, you're fine.
for people. Okay.
I think you're fine. But yeah, and good luck with all your work.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Vanessa. Yeah.